Today, how did a group of peaceful human rights protesters end up with a conviction that carries a maximum sentence of life in prison? And in opinion, writer and activist Soraya Chamali on the importance of female rage. Last year, 15 people chained themselves together around a plane to prevent an immigration removal flight from taking off. They were protesting against the government's deport first, appeal later policy. On Monday, the Stansted 15 were found guilty of an aviation offence which can carry a life sentence. Amnesty International called the decision a crushing blow for human rights. We've been following the case throughout the trial, speaking to those due to board the plane and to the protesters, including Emma Hughes.
Justice will not be done until we are exonerated and the Home Office is held to account for the danger it puts people in every single day.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, how a law born out of a terrorist attack has been used to convict protesters. Who were the Stansted 15 and what were they protesting?
So there were 15 individuals from a campaign group called End Deportation.
Guardian reporter Damien Gale has been following this case from the start.
And they were protesting essentially around the government's hostile environment immigration policy and the way in which migrants to this country are treated.
And the people who were due to get on the plane were going to be deported.
I think it's more appropriate to say that they were immigration removals rather than deportations to Nigeria, Ghana, and in one case, Sierra Leone. There would have been deportees on there, so that would have been people who'd committed a crime and were being deported because they'd committed a crime. But there would have also been people who were being removed because the Home Office had judged that they no longer had a right to stay in the UK. Some of them would have had appeals pending. Some of them would have had ongoing cases with the Home Office. They were effectively people rounded up by the Home Office and put in detention and just held there until it was time for them to go.
We've spoken to someone who was due to board that flight. He wants to remain anonymous, so we've called him David. What do we know about him?
He moved to the UK with his family when he was 19 and he built a life here over the past 13 years and has three children who are British citizens. When he was a student in 2011, he was found guilty of fraud. He pleaded not guilty, but was given the maximum sentence of 18 months. Any foreign national who was sentenced to, over a period of over a year in jail could face automatic deportation. But David didn't think that this would apply to a non-violent offence like his, especially because with British children, he's got very strong links to the country. He was fighting deportation for around 7 years.
I'm just in the state of constant detention because even when I'm not in detention centre and I'm at home, I still feel I can't do nothing.
David thought his case was looking positive, but then he was booked onto a deportation flight.
I think at this stage I was resigned within myself to give up because mentally, emotionally, my family have been struggling. I felt the need to speak to my daughter at that point because she didn't know I was in detention. So I had to explain to her. I've decided to relocate to Nigeria. Yeah, I wouldn't be able to come back, not anytime soon. She would have to visit whenever she can. I mean, that her mom would bring her. And she started crying and she was really upset that day.
Damien, tell us about the night that the Stansted 15 staged their protest.
It was a rainy night. It was 28th of March 2017. And at Stand 505 at Stansted Airport, which is quite far away from where the actual passenger, sort of everyday holidaymaker area is, there was a Boeing 767 standing there. It was operated by Titan Airways, and it was waiting for these 60 migrants to be loaded on board with about twice as many security staff and crew. The End Deportations, the Stansted 15 crew, they drove up via a service road.
And as we were driving there, we read the testimonies of people that we knew were supposed.
This is the voice of Emma Hughes, one of the protesters who spoke to us from court during the trial.
So I read the story of the 21-year-old man whose family had been killed in fighting in Nigeria, and he was terrified for his life. And I remember the words at the end of his testimony. He said, "Is anyone listening? Please can someone help us? Someone rescue us." And I knew that at the same time that I was in that minibus, he was in a coach from a detention centre, travelling to Stansted Airport, probably shackled in waist restraints in fear of his life. And I knew that there were 60 other people also being sent in coaches to Stansted. And we just knew that we had to stop that flight. So once we got to the tarmac, we were quite focused when we were setting up, and it all felt, you know, quite calm. It went as planned, basically, because we all got into position.
No borders, no nations, stop deportations! No borders, no nations, stop deportations!
On getting to this airport this time around, we noticed there were police cars and, supervisors from each coach would come out and, you know, speak to each other. So we knew something was wrong, but we didn't know what it was.
And then, to begin with, the police arrived and started asking us lots of questions. But it was after a sort of, I don't know, maybe 2 to 3 hours, we noticed that they took the stairs away from the Titan plane. And that seemed like a good sign that deportation flight was not leaving that night.
That's the stairs being packed away now. We've just seen the crew leaving the aeroplane, and it looks to me like this flight is not going to be going anywhere tonight, we hope. And we hope that will be enough time for some of the cases who are still in progress.
It was a brilliant feeling to know that hopefully those people had been bought a little more time, and some of them might be able to stay in the UK.
About a few hours after, they came to tell us that some activists are on the runway and they don't think we're going to be going tonight.
Hi mate, can you give us a bit of an update, please?
Hiya, so we're still locked on here underneath the wing of this Titan Airways flight, which was planning to deport tens, if not hundreds of people to Ghana and Nigeria. People who were fearing for their lives from violence and death and torture. As you can see, the ladders, the stairs have all gone, the crew, the cabin crew, the pilots have all gone home for the night. And we've just seen all the coaches which were containing detained people have gone back. So we have successfully shut this flight down.
The mood in the coach that I was of jubilation, because a lot of people were happy. But I was really angry. I was angry because I've already made up my mind that, you know, I just wanted to go. And who are these people? And then why are they delaying my my life? Because I feel like it's been delayed for 7 years. One more day, I wasn't prepared to use it in the UK at that point. They were trying to reschedule it for the next day or the day after or something like that. But this time around, for some reason, they didn't come for me. My lawyer sprung into action. To cancel that ticket, they had to get an injunction from the court. The whole scenario, the whole incident is just a miracle. I'm grateful to God and the people that are around me, such as this Stansted 15.
So David is one of about 11 people on board that flight who have since been granted leave to remain in the UK. Many of the others were very quickly deported on subsequent charter flights.
Damien, 11 out of 60 is a lot of people to have their decisions overturned.
Yeah. And this obviously speaks to the Home Office's policy of deport first and appeal later. This is obviously quite problematic if you've been sent to Nigeria and you're in Lagos. Then it's difficult to find a lawyer who can deal with the British legal system, let alone the money that you need to pay for the various appeals and the various bits of bureaucracy that go through the Home Office, and that's not to mention the fees for the lawyer, him or herself.
And it's worth saying that the Supreme Court did later find that the deport first, appeal later policy was unlawful. And it's clearly been a positive story for some of those on board, certainly for David. But for the protesters, for the Stansted 15, their troubles were just beginning, weren't they? They were initially charged with aggravated trespass.
So yeah, they were all charged with aggravated trespass. But then on the 21st of July, the CPS told them that they were changing the charge to this intentional disruption of an aerodrome, which comes under the heading Endangering the Safety of an Aerodrome in the 1990 Aviation and Maritime Act.
I was sat at a cafe in Vauxhall and I hadn't had an email from my solicitors, and it said something about new charge, and I remember opening it up and sort of reading about this, you know, Maritime and Aviation Security Act. I was like, what's this? And scrolling through, and it had sort of several parts to it, and there were the words maximum life imprisonment, and it was bewildering. I thought, you know, I just remember thinking, this can't be right, but you know, unfortunately it was right, and that was kind of a beginning of this nightmare, where, you know, we faced these charges which are grossly inappropriate, that are completely draconian, and really just trying to crack down on legitimate peaceful protest.
It sounds like a really extreme charge for protesting.
The charge itself was brought in response to the 1988 Lockerbie bombing, when terrorists put a bomb on a Pan Am Flight 103, and it exploded as it was flying over a Scottish town called Lockerbie, killing 243 people and 16 crew. So to twist that law around to apply it to people who've gone and conducted a non-violent protest at an airport seems a bit of a stretch.
I mean, with 30 years on, Lockerbie was this completely different terrorist offence. How did the prosecution argue for that in court?
They argued that there may have been debris left on the runway which could have got sucked into the engines of a landing or taking off jet and caused a disaster like that. They argued that police had to be diverted from the passenger terminals to deal with the protest that was occurring far away in this stand 505, and that could have potentially caused an endangerment to passengers, because if something had happened in the passenger terminal, there might not have been enough police left there to handle whatever crisis was occurring.
Did the protesters themselves talk about their attempts to not endanger people's lives?
They tried to say that the prosecution hadn't really proven that there was a real possibility of endangerment, but they also tried to give the defence of justification. They tried to give the defence that they acted to prevent greater human rights abuses occurring, not only as part of the immigration system operated by the Home Office, but also that would be faced by these people being removed once they were returned back to the countries where they came from.
We endangered no one that night. The only people in danger, were the people who were due to be deported on that flight. What we did was walk across a small piece of grass and then set up a blockade where we all laid down at the back of one plane which had its engine off and was hours away from leaving. Nothing we did was in any way dangerous.
So that was their big hope throughout the trial, that they would be able to give that. And there were legal arguments from the beginning, it seems, trying to persuade the judge that they would be able to do that. He finally agreed and allowed them to give that evidence in their defence. And then at the end of the defence, right before the closing speeches, he turned around and he told the jury that they had to disregard all of that evidence, and that they could only base their verdict on whether or not there was endangerment to the airport.
There's been a lot of up and downs in the trial. It's you know, some days it's felt, you know, we're definitely going to win this, and other days it's all felt hopeless. We've had this charge which carries a maximum of life imprisonment hanging over us, and that does affect your life continually. You know, it affects, you know, my family's life as well. It affects, you know, everyone around you. Obviously, so at the moment I'm think at the moment I'm 10 days away from my due date to give birth, which is the 22nd of December, and to sort of have, you know, such a huge thing as being a mother for the first time at the same time as being on a trial for such a serious charge, it's completely changed my life.
So did you have a feeling that it was going to be a guilty verdict?
I had a feeling it was going to be a guilty verdict, definitely, when the judge started summing up, and this was another point of conflict between the judge and the defence. As he was summing up, he did tell the jury that they might consider the defendant's entry to a restricted area was a risk in itself, which the defence leapt up at their first opportunity once the jury had left the room and said, "No, this sounds like a direction to convict," and they made an application for the discharge of the jury, and the judge essentially turned around to them and said, "Well, if you don't like it, you can always take it to a higher court."
Do you think that could be a basis of the appeal?
I think so. Yeah. I think that could very well be the basis for an appeal in this. I think we'll have to see as well what sentence they get as to how they appeal, because there has been for a long time a kind of precedent in this country that non-violent protesters are not given custodial jail sentences. But recently we've seen people sent to jail, like, for example, earlier in the year, the three chaps who stood on top of lorries outside Preston New Road fracking site in Lancashire were jailed for a year and a half each. And obviously eventually their sentences were quashed and the Court of Appeal agreed that they were disproportionate to the crimes that they'd committed. But it does seem that there is a kind of, the climate or approach towards non-violent protesters is changing, and the prosecutors are becoming more severe towards them.
What this really is a case of trying to completely repress protest. And I don't think it's coincidental that this what we did targeted the Home Office, and the Home Office is very sensitive about, in particular, these deportation flights, because they're so secretive and because they're so brutal, and they know how unpopular they will be with the public if they start to get attention. So really, I think we hit a nerve, and I think that's why we've been targeted in this disproportionate way. And, you know, it just shows how unpopular the government's sort of hostile environment policy really is. The Home Office is putting people in danger every single day. It puts people in danger during dawn raids. It puts people in danger when it drags them into detention centres without fit medical attention. And it puts them in danger when it sends them off in shackles on these deportation charter flights. So really, you know, it's the Home Office that should be charged with endangerment here.
After the guilty verdict on Monday, we called Emma, who was outside the court.
Right now, I'm feeling shocked, I'm feeling angry, I'm feeling pretty devastated, but we are going to keep fighting this, and I know that we will be exonerated, and I know that we're going to stop these brutal, inhumane flights.
Damien will be covering the sentencing of the Stansted 15 when it happens, and no doubt the appeal as well, so do follow him at theguardian.com. Coming up, why it's okay for women to be mad as hell. Now, writer and activist Soraya Chamali on why feminism needs female rage.
When I was about 8 years old, my brother and I were really best friends. We did everything together. We were very close in age. And my father asked me to get up and clear the table and help my mother. And I looked at my brother and he was sort of smiling and smirking. And so I refused. My father's response was the shock that this girl child would say no. And then the disciplining, well, you have to do it. And then the kind of silence of, now what? She's not doing it. She's not going to budge. I don't really think you can probably ultimately be a feminist without understanding anger. Anger is the first line of defense for humans. It's the signal emotion that tells us that something is wrong and something needs to be changed. So if you have a feminist sensibility, you've almost certainly been angry about an unfairness or an injustice, either in your own life or on behalf of other people. I mean, in that sense, I think it's immensely constructive. Yes. It's seen differently for women. I think we grow up learning that anger is destructive or aggressive and violent. Disassociating anger from femininity actually means we can't defend ourselves. We're inhibited from defending ourselves, and that's what feminists do. Feminists put a stake in the ground. So, you know, one of the most enduring criticisms about feminists is that they're too angry and that they're aggressive and inherently hostile. Well, of course it's off-putting to people. Feminist anger is off-putting because anger in women is off-putting. This association with anger and irrationality is very common, but anger is really rational. The question is, why aren't you angry? The irrationality is the lack of anger. And that, I think, makes people even more uncomfortable, right? I mean, the idea that what women are saying is the truth is far more destabilizing to society than the threat that a few women might lie. That idea that women are breaking rules when they get angry, when they display anger and when they claim anger, is even more powerful when that anger is explicitly feminist. The minute you start defending yourself, the minute you stop caring how much people like you, maybe for all the wrong reasons, the more likely you are to help yourself. We insist over and over again in framing anger as something that is bad and destructive. And what I'm saying is that that's false.
That was Soraya Chamali, and her book, Rage Becomes Her, is out now. My thanks to Soraya, and also to Damien Gale, Emma Hughes, and David. Today's producers were Elizabeth Cassin, India Rackerson, and Leah Green. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executives were Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. See you tomorrow.